October of 2014, a drowning death of 19-month-old Kyrie could have been avoided if two people had satisfied their duty of care. The first of those people was the defendant, Anna McCowan, who is not involved in this appeal. She was the daycare provider who was responsible for watching Kyrie on that day when she exited the safety of the fenced yard and went into a canal where she drowned. The second person who failed in his duty that was responsible for this death is the respondent, defendant John Long. When you apply the factual standard that is applicable to a motion for summary judgment, the facts show that he owned the property where the daycare was operating. He was aware that a daycare was operating on the property. He was aware of the canal that flowed across the property outside the fenced yard. He was aware of the danger the canal posed to children if they were to get outside the fence. He was the one responsible for making repairs to the fence and the gate that separated the yard from the canal. He had known that the gate was completely off its hinges for several months prior to the incident. He specifically told McCowan that he would fix the broken gate in the spring of 2014. The children could not open the gates when they functioned properly. And the opening around the broken gate is where Kyrie exited the yard. Of course, the defendant contests some of those facts, but the record includes evidence that supports each and every one of those facts. And so they should be construed and all inferences that arise from those facts in the favor of the plaintiff. In this appeal, the plaintiff asks the court to reverse the district court's grant of summary judgment to respondent Long based on the court's misapplication of the standard for applying facts and upon errors of law. And the standard of review is de novo. I first like to discuss the issue of duty. It's well established in Idaho that the duty owed by an owner of land is dependent upon the status of the plaintiff, whether a trespasser, a licensee, or an invitee. And it's clear that the duties owed to an invitee are greater than those owed to a licensee or a trespasser. So that leads to the first question to be decided is what status was Kyrie when she was on that property? Invitees are people who enter property for the purpose of engaging the business conducted on the property. Conversely, licensees are people who enter the property for personal purposes, such as social guests. In this case, Kyrie and her mother engaged the daycare services of McCowan, which she conducted on the property. They were clearly on the property for the purpose of engaging that business, and therefore should be classified as invitees. Nevertheless, the district court refused to classify them as invitees. The language the court used, I don't think was particularly clear that he was considering them licensees, but he did state he did not believe they were invitees. But the reason given by the court is that when McCowan leased the property from Long, that he wasn't aware she was going to be operating a daycare. There are two or three issues with that. The first being that there is evidence that he did know she was operating a daycare on the property. And whether he knew from the outset or whether he later found out and acquiesced to it, I don't see that it makes a difference. If he knew about it and didn't to do anything to stop that, then he should be held to any responsibility to consider them as an invitee. The other would be that as a jury question, whether or not she was an invitee. The fact that they were there to engage in business is at a minimum a question of fact for the jury to decide what status they were.
So Mr. Whiting, are you suggesting that Ms. Duncan and her daughter were invitees to both McCowan and Long, and could they be an invitee as far as McCowan is concerned, since she's the person who's conducting the business and the licensee as it relates to Mr. Long?
Thank you, Your Honor. I have not found any cases where a plaintiff is classified as one for one defendant and as a as a different classification for a different defendant. I've only seen cases where a plaintiff is classified as either an invitee or a licensee, and not both, depending on who they were suing. And I think the public policy would support that, Your Honor. It seems if a person is coming onto property, they should be able to determine whether they're an invitee or a licensee so that they can be aware of what duties are owed to them when they come onto the property. And it doesn't make a lot of sense that any person coming onto a property where business is being conducted, that they would have to inquire or investigate whether or not the business owner was also the property owner, or to investigate whether or not the property owner was aware of the business that was being conducted. It seems almost impossible.
If your premise is correct, then Long's knowledge of what McGowan was doing on the property is irrelevant, isn't it?
Honor, Your Honor, I agree with that. And that was going to be my final point, that it doesn't matter whether he knew or not, that that if she was an invitee for McGowan, then she is strictly an invitee. But in this case, there is evidence that he did know. And so should be no question that that standard.
But doesn't duty usually turn on foreseeability? And so knowing that that child is going to be on the property, it seems to me, is something that's relevant to the duty question.
Foreseeability is an important inquiry in the duty question, no doubt there. And it can apply to a person's status as an invitee, but before deciding the duty, we would have to decide whether or not they are an invitee. Once we determine whether they're an invitee, then we would determine the duty. Now, the duty owed to an invitee is a duty of reasonable care or ordinary care, which basically requires the actor to act reasonably to protect against reasonably foreseeable injury to the invitee. And so in that regard, yes, there is a question of foreseeability, which again is a question of fact for a jury to decide whether or not the harm that is to be protected against could be caused by the action that we are asserting is the duty of the landlord.
We know for a certainty which facts the court deemed as undisputed. In reviewing the memorandum decision, there wasn't a section on facts. It just goes straight into the analysis. And although there are facts mentioned in the analysis, I was a little uncertain as to whether the court was weighing the evidence or just determining whether the evidence was disputed or not.
Your Honor, it certainly isn't clear, but I had the same reaction, and it certainly seems as though the court was weighing the evidence, as the court used terms like there wasn't enough evidence or there wasn't sufficient evidence. And the court did acknowledge and recognize some evidence that opposed the court's conclusion as to what the facts were. And so it seems that the court improperly engaged in several instances in weighing the evidence and not applying the summary judgment standard to construe that evidence in favor of the plaintiff as the non-moving party.
Since we're talking about facts, I want to make sure that I understand one. Was the canal located on the landowner's property, and is there any dispute over that?
Your Honor, it is located on the landowner's property. It crosses across the eastern boundary of the property on the property. And Mr. Long has never raised that point, has never suggested that the canal was not on his property. That was something that the court sua sponte threw into its decision and blindsided us. And so as a part of our motion for reconsideration, we submitted evidence in the form of plats and deeds that indicate where that canal easement is located, and it was clearly located on the property.
But counsel, we have no idea what portion of the canal was entered by the child before the drowning occurred, correct? The child could have entered the property, it could have entered the canal through someone else's property.
It's possible, Your Honor. The evidence leaves open that possibility that the child entered the canal, crossed over the property line and entered the canal there. However, the condition of the canal is exactly the same all along. And there is a bridge there, but we can't know whether the child entered the canal and then moved up the canal or what happened.
I don't mean the question to come out as crass. I understand the sensitivity to everyone in this case, but was the child's body found upstream or downstream from the residents involved?
It was found upstream from the residents involved.
So wouldn't that suggest then that the canal was entered from someone else's property?
It suggests that's a possibility, Your Honor, but we can't know that she didn't enter the canal downstream and then work her way upstream trying to get to the bridge to climb out. We just can't know that. And in the end, Your Honor, I don't think that it makes any difference. This canal benefits Mr. Long and his property. It crosses his property, and the fact that she may have entered that canal a few feet across the property line should not absolve him from his negligence. If it was reasonably foreseeable when he had a broken gate that she could get out of the fence through that broken gate and go into the canal, it doesn't matter where she went into the canal. Maybe if it was 5 miles down, there's a line to be drawn somewhere, but we don't have to draw that line in this case. In this case, it happened at least within a few feet of the property line, and it was certainly reasonably foreseeable to Mr. Long that if she got out of the yard, that's exactly what would happen.
But if the child were to encounter the hazard outside the property, would that take this case outside of a premises liability theory?
Your Honor, I don't think so. There was a case that was cited somewhere in these materials, the Heath case, I believe, where a person was going across property that was adjacent to a business. They slipped on some ice and were injured, and then they sued the business, but there was no evidence that that business had engaged in any negligent conduct, that that business had breached any duty, that the business had failed to do anything that led to the injury. Their only connection was that they were located next to the property. In this case, we have a much different scenario. We have a scenario where this gate is broken and Mr. Long is the one responsible to fix it, and he's known about it for several months, and he knows that there's a daycare being operated on the property. I think any person would see that as a problem and see that that is a danger to the children. And so
I understand that argument, but I guess my question is a little different, and that is, isn't a premises liability claim premised on the notion that the actual cause of the injury, not the proximate cause, but the actual cause of the injury is the defective condition of the property? I mean, in this case, the gate did not injure the child.
Your Honor, you're correct. The gate did not injure the child, but going to the standards of analyzing the duty and analyzing the proximate cause, the case law is referring to reasonable foreseeability, not ownership or even control of that instrumentality. And you know, there was the Sharp v. W.H. Moore case that we cited in our brief, where the landlord is required to lock the doors at night, and an employee was in working, the doors were left unlocked, and a criminal came in and injured her severely. And the court concluded that even though this was a criminal that the landlord had no control over, that the landlord breached the duty by failing to lock the door. I don't think the court would have reached a different decision if he had pulled her out of the building into the alley off the property. I think this landlord still should have been held liable because the negligence occurred on the property, and the negligence occurred with regard to the property, and that negligence led to the foreseeable result, even if that consequence occurred somewhere that the landowner did not have control over.
Mr. Way, I'm sure you've had more time to think through some of these issues than I have, but one of the things that I find unusual about this case is typically when we're dealing with children and premise liability, we're dealing with a fence that was intended to keep the children out. This case involves a fence that was intended to keep people in, and in this case, it was a child. If on a different boundary of the fence, there had been a broken gate and there had been a trampoline and the child had left through that gate and jumped on the trampoline and broke her ankle, could you be making the same kind of argument that you're making here today? And if so, would that be proper?
I think that would depend, Your Honor, on where that trampoline is located. You know, if that trampoline is located nearby and was something that you should anticipate that the child would get onto, again, the standard is foreseeability. If it's foreseeable that the child would do that and get onto the trampoline and be injured, then I think there is the possibility.
So a property owner then would have to fence out children not only from the nuisances within their property, but the nuisances without the property?
Perhaps I misunderstood your question. But if it is reasonably foreseeable that this child would exit the property and engage on something that was harmful, and it's clear that that wasn't a definite possibility, then yes, under the standard, then they should be able to assert liability against that landlord for failure to do protection. Again, we have a case where it's known that these children are there. It's known that the gate keeps them in, and it's known that the gate's broken. It's known that the danger is right there. The harm is foreseeable, and that seems to be the standard that this court has applied in the past to issues of duty and proximate cause.
So, Mr. Whiting, I want to return to a question I had, and that is, let's continue with Justice Mohler's hypothetical. The child gets out of the daycare enclosure, goes across the lot to the neighboring trampoline, jumps on the trampoline, breaks her leg. Is the owner of the trampoline subject to the same duty that the owner of the daycare is bound by? I mean, would the child become an invitee to the owner of the trampoline, even though the owner of the trampoline has nothing to do with the financial relationship between the daycare and the little girl?
Your Honor, I think the child's status is dependent upon the property that she was on and the party that she was dealing with in that case, because we have two different properties and two different owners. But and so as against the landlord, against the person where she left the property, she certainly would be she was an invitee, because that's what her status was on that person's property, and that's where the act of negligence occurred. I haven't had the opportunity to analyze trampoline liability, but
wouldn't she be a trespasser as far as the trampoline is concerned?
She would be.
So that suggests that there can be two different duties to various tortfeasors.
Possibly, but as a result of there being two different pieces of property, and so the the duty owned by each individual owner of the property would be determined by the status with regard to that particular property. And so because there are two pieces of property, she would, the duty owed by the landowner where she was an invitee is that of an invitee. The duty of the other owner where she had no connection to other than as a trespasser would be as a trespasser. But she would not be both an invitee and a trespasser on both pieces of property. And I believe that's the answer. I hope that satisfies the court's question. But again, when a person's actions or inactions cause a foreseeable result, then there is a duty to protect against that harm. And that duty is flexible. In cases where there is a great risk of harm, but the effort needed to prevent it is very low, then the foreseeability of that harm is also only needs to be very low. And so in this case, there was a foreseeability of great harm, of death. Fixing the gate should have been a very easy thing to do. And so the degree of foreseeability is lessened in this case. I don't think that it needs to be lessened because her going into that canal was certainly greatly and highly foreseeable. I see that I'm beyond my time. Does the court have more questions? And I reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Whiting and Mrs. Paulsgraf. Mr. Obarn.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. It's a true honor to be here. This is my first time presenting oral argument before this court, and so I'm truly honored to be here and appreciate the opportunity to present argument on behalf of my client respondent, Mr. Long. As I think one of the key issues to first understand is the standard of review here, in that it's been alleged that and argued in the briefing at least that the district judge improperly weighed the evidence. However, in order to survive summary judgment, a plaintiff who bears the burden at trial of establishing each element of their claim has to raise a certain quantum of evidence in order to survive summary judgment. And I think that was the issue with the district court here, is that there wasn't sufficient evidence, meaning it didn't rise above the scintilla of evidence that's required in order to survive summary judgment. And I think that goes, and so I think that's the first issue here, is we have to realize that plaintiffs did not meet their burden of presenting a burden of proof of presenting evidence to establish a material question of fact that would warrant going to trial. And so we have to look at some of these facts. And first is some of the key facts anyway, is that McCowan was not operating a daycare when she first started to lease the property. It's been, McCowan's testimony was initially that Long knew right from the get-go that she was operating a business. But then she was presented with the fact that she did not have a daycare license until approximately 18 months after she moved into the property. At that time, she recanted her testimony and said, basically, that she wasn't operating when she first moved in, and it wasn't until later, and that it may have only been the presence of daycare toys and the fact that she texted him that daycare kids would pick up toys, but there's no evidence that she actually ever told him she was operating a business there for money. In fact, when she first moved in, her testimony is that she was watching another child, but not for money, that it was not a business. And so there's no evidence here that Mr. Long was informed that she was operating a business at any time. As well, there's no lease agreement that obligates Mr. Long to make any repairs to the property. His testimony is only that he felt responsible to make repairs that he was made aware of, but that's something that he undertook voluntarily, and there was no legal obligation to make any repairs. There's no evidence.
Once he undertakes that obligation, though, he's duty bound to do it in a non-negligent manner, correct?
That is correct. If he voluntarily undertakes to make a repair, he has to do it in a non-negligent manner. And the fence in the gate in question here had fallen off previously, and he had repaired it. But there is no evidence that his repairs were negligent in nature. It did fall off again, but both hinges this second time broke. And Ms. McCowan testified in her deposition that that was due to the strong winds and the weather. There is no evidence whatsoever that any attempt to repair it the first time was negligent, or that he did anything that was not reasonably cautious in making that initial repair. But you are correct, Your Honor. And after that initial repair, he never made another attempt to repair that specific gate. In fact, it was McCowan that undertook the repairs on that gate. Although she didn't put it back in its original position, she testified that she laid it up on its side and blocked the opening, that she secured it to the fence, and that it was flush. And she did that in the spring of 2014 and testified that she allowed children out in the yard from May or June of 2014 up until this incident occurred in October of 2014. And so she testified that she inspected the yard, that she did not believe that this fence, even being on its side, was an issue or that children could get out of it. She testified that she visually inspected the gate the day the incident occurred to ensure that that the child could not get out of it. And as well, the yard and this gate were inspected by health and welfare and passed a health and welfare inspection with the gate on its side in the condition it was in at the time that this incident occurred. McCowan testified that Ms. Duncan inspected the property herself and saw the gate on its side, and it wasn't a concern to her. Ms. Duncan has never raised any issue on that or contested that fact. Two of the boys that McCowan was watching on the day that KR died told police that they would leave the backyard by crawling under the fence, and that McCowan testified, testified that she believed that they were telling the truth. Duncan does not know how KR was able to get out of the backyard, but testified that the police investigated a gap between the deck and the fence, and that KR could have potentially gotten through that gap. McCowan testified that she did not see how KR got out of the backyard, and that her, and I think this is the critical point here, is that she testified that the only reason that KR was able to get out of the backyard and eventually make her way to the canal was because she left her unattended. That's not a condition of the property. That's an action that's taking place on the property. She testified that if she had been there and been present, no way KR could have gotten out of the property.
But when we have multiple possible tortfeasors, I think this court's case law indicates that we're supposed to ask the jury whether someone's conduct was a substantial factor in bringing about the injury or the death in this case. So what would be wrong with asking the jury in this case, was defendant Long's failure to repair the gate a substantial factor in bringing about the death of this child?
Because there's no evidence that the gate itself was a factor in bringing about the death of the child. There's no evidence that she got out through the gate. Ms. McCowan did testify that she believed she may have gotten out of the gate, but that's based off of the only testimony that she may have gotten out of the gate, and her belief is that she thinks that she saw another one of the boys that she was babysitting that day or tending that day come in through that gate. But she even testified that she does not know for sure. She can't. That wasn't an important memory to her at that time, and that she's unsure if she actually did see that. That is the only evidence. That's the circumstantial evidence that they're relying on that she got out of this gate. McCowan testified it was not possible for a child to get out this gate. That she inspected it that day. That it was not possible. The only this case only involves a claim of premises liability. That means that it has to be a condition of the property that caused the damage. The undisputed testimony here is from a count. It's not that the gate caused the damage, but that the child could not have gotten out the gate or the yard itself, regardless of how she got out of the yard, if she had not left her unattended. And so it, in this case, it's not appropriate to even get to that point of presenting that question of multiple tortfeasors to the jury, because there's no evidence to support the fact that it was the gate itself that caused, that permitted the child to get out of the yard or ultimately caused her death. Again, KR was found in a portion of the canal, not on Mr. Long's property, but on the property belonging to someone else. There's no evidence that she fell into the canal on Mr. Long's property, or that Mr. Long owned the canal or had control over the canal or control over the area where she entered the canal.
Mr. Whiting mentioned earlier, Mr. O'Born, that this portion of the canal was on Long's property. The trial court obviously made a different finding. On page 5 of the memorandum decision, the court concluded that, or I guess found that, the drowning occurred in a canal that was not on Long's property. Who's right?
The canal does run across Mr. Long's property, but where the child was found is not on Mr. Long's property.
Okay, so when the judge said that the drowning occurred in a canal that was not on Long's property, perhaps it just misperceived the issue a little bit then?
It may have been, Your Honor. At first, the district judge decided that there was no evidence that the canal was on Mr. Long's property. We haven't contested that it was on his property, Your Honor. On the motion to reconsider, we didn't have an opportunity to brief that issue anyway, but we're not contesting that the canal itself runs across the property. But Mr. Long is only the serving estate owner. He does not own that canal itself. He only owns the property underneath the canal. And so even then, it's not a condition on his property that he has control over that is the mechanism of injury and death in this case. It's property, first of all, the canal itself belongs to someone else. And then the evidence, there is no evidence that the child entered the canal from Mr. Long's property. And so I think one of the first places we have to stop on when we look at this is the question of duty, and duty is a question of law. In this case, the district court did determine, at least looking indirectly at the arguments or at the reasoning, that KR and Ms. Duncan were licensees and not invitees. There's no evidence in this case that Long invited or enticed Duncan or KR onto the property, or that even knew that they were there. They were not there pursuing any business operated by Long or to confer any benefit on him. At most, they were on the property with his passive permission and were thus licensees as it pertains to Mr. Long. And I do believe that you can have different statuses, or that an injured party can have different statuses depending upon the relationship with the tortfeasor, or the alleged tortfeasor in this case. Because that's how duties are found, is based off of relationships. And I haven't found a case law that specifically refers to this, the various duties, or that the duty can change. But if you look at Idaho Jury Instruction 3.13.1, and this isn't cited anywhere in our briefs, but because it wasn't a direct argument that was being made, but as to the question that was asked of counsel about these duties and whether they can change or whether there can be different ones, IGI 3.13.1 talks about the scope of the duty. And it says that a visitor may be an invitee for a limited purpose, or the invitation may be restricted in scope. So it says if the visitor enters any part of the premises or makes any use of it beyond the scope of the invitation, or remains on the premises after expiration of the time within which to accomplish the purpose of the invitation, the visitor status as an invitee may end, and the visitor may become a licensee or trespasser as is defined in other instructions. And so certainly KR left the portion of the premises that she was invited to be on. But I think more importantly, this goes to the fact that there can be, that this isn't a, the status of an injured party is not set in stone. It can change based off of the circumstances and the relationships of the parties. So if they are considered, and as they should be, as licensees, there's no duty to affirmatively act to protect them. The duty is only to notify them of dangerous conditions or activities on the property for which they are unaware. And in this case, it's clearly established and undisputed that the fence was on its side. When Ms. Duncan came in and inspected the property, Ms. McCowan said it was visible from the backyard, that Ms. Duncan went into the backyard and could have seen it, and that Ms. McCowan felt that Ms. Duncan didn't consider it an issue, and so Ms. McCowan didn't consider it an issue. Ms. Duncan testified that she saw the canal and was aware of the presence of the canal. So if they're determined to be licensees, there is no duty that's been breached. If that's the duty, then it was fulfilled, and there's no breach there.
Do we know anything about, one of the things that's odd about this case is it's a canal drowning that took place on October 18th, and that's kind of late in the year for a canal drowning. Do we know anything about the condition of the canal and whether or not the property owner or the tenant were aware of unusual water conditions in the canal, or whether usually there wasn't water in the canal at that time of year?
There's nothing of that evidence of that sort in the record, Your Honor. So even if Duncan and Kay are considered to be invitees, no duties imposed, because the primary question when we evaluate a premises liability case is, in particular between a tenant and a landlord, is who had control of the premises. And this is not addressed at all by the appellants. And this is clearly a major issue litigated in Forbush versus Sagecrest, as the justices are aware. Even though, for example, Justice Brody had a dissent in that case, the dissent raised this issue of, primarily about third parties that are neither an owner or occupier of land, but this issue of control was never in dispute. The fact that it's who has control determines liability is reiterated, I think, five different times in that case. In this case, there is no evidence that Mr. Long had control of the subject premises at any of the relevant times in question, when KR was there, in particular on the day when KR passed away. So there's no evidence that he had control, in particular as to his tenant, Ms. McCowan, who had control over the property at all relevant times in this case. And so both Forbush and then Stiles itself, in Stiles versus Amundsen, it says that a landlord generally is not responsible for injuries to third persons in privity with the tenant, which are caused by the failure to keep or put the demised premises in good repair. Now,
if Long says he'll fix the fence and doesn't fix the fence, doesn't that change the analysis?
No, it does not, Your Honor, because he never actually undertook to repair the fence. The duties that can be imposed are when one voluntarily undertakes to repair a fence. So that's the first thing, is he never actually undertook to repair the fence. The second is Ms. McCowan may be responsible or able to rely on a representation that Mr. Long would repair a fence, but Ms. Duncan and KR could not rely on that. At all times when they were associated, the alleged representation to repair the fence occurred sometime in the winter of 2013-2014. Ms. McCowan used that backyard as a daycare starting in the spring of 2014, all the way up until this incident occurred in October of 2014. That representation was made before Ms. Duncan or KR came onto the property. And so they had no reason to rely on it. They believed that they used the property as it was when they entered the property, which was with the gate on its side. And the evidence is that no child could get out of that gate with it on its side, Your Honor. And so The property, this goes to a later issue, but the property was in reasonably good condition based off of the repairs that Ms. McCowan made, because it prevented, undisputed evidence is that it prevented children from being able to get out of the yard through that gate. So while both the appellant argues that this standard or that no duty isn't typically imposed on a landlord or parties in privity with a tenant, that this only applies in situations with licensees. But it's, although it's been raised in cases involving duties owed to licensees, it's never been limited to the court that way. In, for example, the Court of Appeals in Robinson versus Mueller states that tenants are responsible to third parties, but that a landlord can still be liable in limited circumstances. Then in footnote two, the Court of Appeals in Robinson says that that the Harrison case makes clear that the duty of a landlord to third parties is not one of reasonable care under the circumstances, because there would be no need to identify the circumstances when liability is imposed if it was simply the general duty. And then Robinson itself goes on to state that landlords are generally not responsible for injuries to third parties in privity with the tenant that is relied on in both Stiles and then Forbush. So the next issue then is that there's no evidence of a breach, because the undisputed evidence is that the property was in reasonably safe condition, or that KR's death was, and there's no evidence that KR's death was caused by any hidden or concealed danger. The appellants don't argue that this was a hidden or concealed danger. Obviously, it was open and obvious, so it wasn't hidden or concealed, and no duty to warn of the fence itself because it was visible. Ms. McCowan said that Ms. Duncan could see it and that she wasn't concerned about it. But even if the duty does exist towards Duncan and KR's invitees, the evidence is the property was in a reasonably safe condition. McCowan testified that after the subject gate fell off, she secured it in such a way that children could not get out of the yard through the gate, and she allowed children to use the backyard from May or June of 2014 until October, with no one getting out of the yard, according to her. It's uncontroverted testimony that the gate was secure. It was in a reasonably safe condition. Thus, the duty was fulfilled. There was no breach of that duty by any affirmative act or omission on the part of Mr. Long. Again, there's no evidence in the record of how KR got out of the yard. There's no evidence that she left through the subject gate. There is evidence that she left by going under the gap between the fence and the deck. McCowan testified that she thinks but is not sure she saw a boy come back in through the yard through the subject gate, but that's speculative assumption. And that doesn't, just because she thinks she might have but is not certain that she saw a boy come back in through the gate, does not mean that a child could get out through the gate. Her testimony was that there was a gap, and it's believed that the boy, if this is indeed what happened, that the boy may be pushed from the outside of the fence, which may have been possible. There's no evidence that a child could push from the inside of the fence, because it was the gate was flush up against the fence from the inside. So there's no evidence that this gate itself had any contributed in any way to the subject incident. Next, there's evidence that it was, there's no evidence it was the condition of the subject property that caused KR's death. As already addressed, it is, Ms. McCowan testified that this would not have happened had she continued to properly supervise the child, but she left the backyard and left her unsupervised, and that's the only reason KR was able to get out of the yard and cause the injury. And so in Turpin 133 Idaho 244, it says that while we have previously recognized that a landlord may have responsibilities for assuring that the rented premises are safe, we have imposed that duty only as the physical premises. Here we are asked to impose a responsibility for activities taking place on the rented property which in no way implicate the physical condition of the house or the surrounding property. And that's exactly what is at issue in this case, is that it's not the cause of death or the contributing factor, the but-for analysis or substantial cause, wasn't the position of the gate, because there's no evidence that contributed to the death here. It's the fact that Ms. McCowan failed to properly supervise the child, which is an activity on the property, and thus not a basis for a premises liability. Ms. McCowan was asked in her deposition, if you had been present in the backyard on October 18, 2014, KR would not have escaped the backyard, would she? Her answer was no. She was then asked, and the only reason that she was able to get outside the fence was because you weren't there, correct? And her answer was yep. So McCowan's, this conduct also satisfies the requirements of an intervening or superseding cause when the factors outlined in Kramer v. Slater are addressed and analyzed. And I've argued that in my brief, and I'm not going to reiterate all those arguments, but I identify each one of those factors. And it's the same facts that I've already reiterated ad nauseum to you already. And so I'm not going to restate those factors, but this is, her conduct is a intervening or superseding cause and satisfies all the factors for that. The appellant has argued that wasn't brought up before the trial court, but that's not true. We didn't use the words, proximate cause was an issue that was raised, and we didn't use the words intervening or superseding cause, but we did argue to the court multiple different times that it was Ms. McCowan's conduct and negligence and not a condition of the property that was at issue here. Oral argument before the district court stated in the record, in the augmented record at page 4, 14, and 44, I tell the district court that this case involves the death of KR, who died when she was unattended by McCowan, and that the only reason she was able to get out was because she was left unattended by Ms. McCowan. And that, again, it was argued in the supplemental reply memo in the augmented record at page 97 in that brief. And one of the reasons why some of these issues weren't raised as directly is because the motion for summary judgment was filed before Ms. McCowan was deposed in this case. And so all the issues were raised in summary judgment before Ms. McCowan was deposed. And then appellants filed for a motion to continue. And so these issues were raised after Ms. McCowan's deposition, talking about the fact that she testified that was her conduct and not a condition of the property that caused the death. So then, Your Honors, it is finding that Long did not control the canal, which the district court correctly found was the cause of KR's death. He did not own or control the canal. The evidence is that the reasonable inferences from the evidence is that she had to have entered the canal from someone else's property and not Mr. Long's property. There is no evidence in the record that she entered the canal from Mr. Long's property. And so unless any of the justices have any questions, I just state that summary judgment was appropriate in this case because there's no duty imposed on Long. The property itself was in a reasonably safe condition, and McCowan's conduct was a supervening or intervening cause of KR's death, which would cut off the proximate cause analysis. And Long did not own or control the canal in question or the property where KR was found and apparently entered the canal. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does the appellant have?
8 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir?
Thank you. First, to address the assertion that Long did not admit he was obligated to affix the gate. He did expressly state that if he was aware of the problem, that he was obligated to fix it. It wasn't that he felt like he was obligated. He expressly stated that he was obligated to do so. He did waffle on that a little bit from time to time, but he did admit that it was his obligation. And he did fix the other parts of the offense in this case. He attempted to fix this gate. Your Honor, Mr. Long would have us think that his first attempt to repair the gate was completed or adequate. There were four gates in this fence. This one fell in the winter of 2012-2013, or one hinge was broken. He attempted to repair that hinge, and then the next winter, none of the other gates fell or had any problem, but this gate now completely fell from its hinges. That suggests that he didn't repair it properly, and that the repair was not actually completed, that perhaps he should have done more to repair that. And so he did make that attempt and failed in doing that, and then had an obligation to come back and make sure it was done right the next year, which is undisputed that he didn't. Mr. O'Born mentioned that the other boys at the daycare climbed under the fence. They made that statement to police officers, but when the police officers later interviewed them, and this is in Ms. McCallum's testimony, that they recanted that and admitted that they came in, or that they went out through that back garden gate. And they also told the police officers at that time that they saw Kyrie peeking around that back garden gate on that day. And so she was there, she was back at that garden gate, she was outside of that garden gate, peeking around. And that evidence is cited in our brief as well.
McCallum. Just so I'm clear, looking at the exhibits in the augmented record 121, 122, they depict the gate being, from my perspective, just looking at the photos, about 3 feet high. Would you say that was fair, approximately?
Yeah, the gate's tipped on its side, and so it's about 3 feet high at that point. I think that's fair. And McCallum made a number of corrections during her testimony. She had said that she had secured the gate, but she also said that the gate was sitting at a kind of an inverted V, so it was leaning and not up tight against the bottom of the fence to secure it. And she did testify that she saw one child coming back in under the gate, so it clearly was not fully secured and was capable of the children getting out. The fact that these boys saw Kyrie peeking around the corner of that gate, and again, she's 19 months old. She's not 3 feet tall and her head sticking up over this gate. She's peeking around where that opening was available for her to get out. Sky Duncan, in her deposition, never admitted that she saw the gate and that it was a problem. She testified that she didn't notice the gate, that it did not catch her attention. The reason for that, I could only begin to speculate, but she testified that she did not recognize that gate as a problem. Now, that doesn't mean that she saw it and ruled it out. But the other part of that is, Your Honors, that the open and obvious doctrine has been abolished in Idaho since 1989. In the Harrison v. Taylor case, the court abolished the open and obvious doctrine. And so the fact that it was seen by Duncan, or that she was aware of it, or even if she'd been warned of it, really isn't material, because that doctrine just does not apply in any of these cases. The argument that control of the premises is the primary factor really is only limited to cases where the application is to licensees. The Stiles case was a social guest. The Forbush case was social guest of an owner, but the case was brought against the Property Owners Association, which didn't have any ownership interest in the property, and that's why the case was decided against the plaintiff. It wasn't a claim against the landowner. The Robinson case went to great lengths to describe that there's a different standard that applies between invitees and licensees. And the court expressly distinguished itself from the Harrison case, which is an invitee case. And they distinguished it on that basis, that it involved an invitee. And so to apply those rules that we see in the licensee cases does not translate to what we see in the invitee cases. The Harrison case is a great example. This is one where there was a dispute over who was responsible to fix a hole in the sidewalk. Was it the landlord or was it the tenant? And there was evidence going both ways. The court reversed summary judgment and said that the landlord could be responsible if it's determined that he was could be liable if it's determined he's responsible for repairing that hole in the sidewalk. And so we believe this case should follow Harrison. You know, that Long was responsible to fix that gate. The fact that the gate was not repaired led to Kyrie entering that canal. There is evidence that she went out through that gate, as I just mentioned. But there's no evidence of any other potential exit point. There's the discussion about the gap under the fence, but again, the boys recanted that the next day, and also the police measured that gap and determined that it was not sufficient for Kyrie to climb under. The only means of egress from that yard was the back gate that was not secured. And so that is enough at least to create an inference that that's where she exited the property. McCowan did admit that the death would not have occurred if she had fulfilled her duty, but at the end of her testimony, she also said that it would not have happened if Long had fixed the gate. She was asked specifically, she said, well, Sky Duncan's not responsible, Kyrie's not responsible, and she agreed with those statements. She agreed that she was responsible. When she was asked if she believed Long was not responsible, she said no. If he'd fixed the gate, this wouldn't have happened. On the superseding cause argument, that's an affirmative defense that has to be raised. And it was not raised, and it was not sufficiently raised or argued as a superseding cause. They argued other points that were that might be a corollary of those same facts, but they did not argue or raise superseding cause, and therefore cannot be allowed to raise on appeal. I see I'm out of time.
Any other comments, questions? Hearing none, this matter is now under advisement and we will render a decision. Thank you both. Court's in recess.
Thank you.
See you both.